Chapter 27. Crupper, to receive the lovely riders lest they should fall, and shouting out shrill cries of Shmalik, Amanik, or however else these words may be pronounced, and flogging off the people right and left with the buffalo thong. But the dear creatures are even more closely disguised than at Constantinople. Their bodies are enveloped with a large black silk hood, like a cab head. The fashion seemed to be to spread their arms out and give this covering all the amplitude of which it was capable, as they leered and ogled you from under their black masks with their big rolling eyes. Everybody has big rolling eyes here, unless, to be sure, they lose one of ophthalmia. The Arab women are some of the noblest figures I have ever seen. The habit of carrying jars on the head always gives the figure grace and motion, and the dress the women wear certainly displays it to full advantage. I have brought a complete one home with me, at the service of any lady for a masked ball. It consists of a coarse blue dress of calico, open in front, and fastened with a horn button. 3 yards of blue stuff for a veil, on the top of the veil a jar, to be balanced on the head, and a little black strip of silk, to fall over the nose, and leave the beautiful eyes full liberty to roll and roam. But such a costume, not aided by any stays or any other article of dress whatever, can be worn only by a very good figure. I suspect it won't be borrowed for many balls next season. The men, a tall, handsome, noble race, are treated like dogs. I shall never forget riding through the crowded bazaars, my interpreter, or lack waste a place, ahead of me to clear the way, when he took his whip, and struck it over the shoulders of a man who could not, or would not make way. The man turned round an old venerable handsome face, with awfully sad eyes, and a beard long and quite gray. He did not make the least complaint, but slunk out of the way, piteously shaking his shoulder. The sight of that indignity gave me a sickening feeling of disgust. I shouted out to the cursed lackey to hold his hand, and forbade him ever in my presence to strike old or young more, but everybody is doing it. The whip is in everybody's hands. The pasha's running footman, as he goes bustling through the bazaar, the doctor's attendant, as he soberly threads the crowd on his mare, the negro slave, who is riding by himself, the most insolent of all, strikes and slashes about without mercy, and you never hear a single complaint. How to describe the beauty of the streets to you, the fantastic splendor, the variety of the houses, and archways, and hanging roofs, and balconies, and porches, the delightful accidents of light and shade which checker them, the noise, the bustle, the brilliancy of the crowd, the interminable vast bazaars with their barbaric splendor. There is a fortune to be made for painters in Cairo, and materials for a whole academy of them. I never saw such a variety of architecture, of life, of picturesqueness, of brilliant color, and light and shade. There is a picture in every street, and at every bazaar stall. Some of these our celebrated watercolor painter, Mr. Lewis, has produced with admirable truth and exceeding minuteness and beauty, but there is room for 100 to follow him, and should any artist, by some rare occurrence, read this, who has leisure, and wants to break new ground, let him take heart, and try a winter in Cairo, where there is the finest climate, and the best subjects for his pencil. A series of studies of Negroes alone would form a picture book, delightfully grotesque. Mounting my donkey today, I took a ride to the desolate noble old buildings outside the city, known as the Tombs of the Caliphs. Every one of these edifices, with their domes, and courts, and minarets, is strange and beautiful. In one of them there was an encampment of Negro slaves newly arrived. Some scores of them were huddled against the sunny wall, two or three of their masters lounged about the court, or lay smoking upon carpets. There was one of these fellows, a straight-nosed ebony-faced Abyssinian, with an expression of such sinister good humor in his handsome face as would form a perfect type of villainy. He sat leering at me, over his carpet, as I endeavored to get a sketch of that incarnate rascality. "I've me some money," said the fellow. know what you are about. You will sell my picture for money when you get back to Europe. Let me have some of it now. But the very rude and humble designer was quite unable to depict such a consummation and perfection of roguery, so flung him a cigar, which he began to smoke, grinning at the giver. I requested the interpreter to inform him, by way of assurance of my disinterestedness, that his face was a great deal too ugly to be popular in Europe, and that was the particular reason why I had selected it. Then one of his companions got up and showed us his black cattle. The male slaves were chiefly lads, and the women young, well-formed, and abominably hideous. The dealer pulled her blanket off one of them, and bade her stand up, which she did with a great deal of shuddering modesty. She was coal black, her lips were the size of sausages, her eyes large and good-humored. The hair wool on this young person's head was curled, and greased into 1,000 filthy little ringlets. She was evidently the beauty of the flock. They are not unhappy. They look to being bought, as many a spinster looks to an establishment in England. Once in a family they are kindly treated and well clothed, and fatten, and are the merriest people of the whole community. These were of a much more savage sort than the slaves I had seen in the horrible market at Constantinople, where I recollect the following young creature, too. Indeed it is a very fair likeness of her. Whilst I was looking at her, and forming pathetic conjectures regarding her fate, smiling very good-humoredly, and bidding the interpreter ask me to buy her for £20. From these tombs of the caliphs the desert is before you. It comes up to the walls of the city, and stops at some gardens which spring up all of a sudden at its edge. You can see the first station house on the Suez Road, and so from distance point to point, could ride thither alone without a guide. Asinus trotted gallantly into this desert for the space of a quarter of an hour. There we were, taking care to keep our back to the city walls, in the real actual desert. Mounds upon mounds of sand, stretching away as far as the eye can see, until the dreary prospect fades away in the yellow horizon. I had formed a finer idea of it out of Othon. Perhaps in a simum it may look more awful. The only adventure that befell in this romantic place was that Asinus's legs went deep into a hole, whereupon his rider went over his head, and bit the sand, and measured his length there, and upon this hint rose up, and rode home again. No doubt one should have gone out for a couple of days' march as it was. The desert did not seem to me sublime, only uncomfortable. Very soon after this perilous adventure the sun likewise dipped into the sand, but not to rise therefrom so quickly as I had done, and I saw this daily phenomenon of sunset with pleasure, for I was engaged at that hour to dine with our old friend Jay, who has established himself here in the most complete Oriental fashion. You remember Jay, and what a dandy he was, the faultlessness of his boots and cravats, the brilliance eye of his waistcoats and kid gloves. We have seen his splendor in Regent Street, in the Tuileries, or on the Toledo. My first object on arriving here was to find out his house, which he has taken far away from the haunts of European civilization, in the Arab quarter. It is situated in a cool, shady, narrow alley, so narrow that it was with great difficulty His Highness Ibrahim Pasha happening to pass at the same moment that my little procession of two donkeys, mounted by self and valet de place, with the two donkey boys our attendants, could range ourselves along the wall, and leave room for the august cavalcade. His Highness having rushed on with an affable and good-humored salute to our imposing party, we made J.'s quarters, and, in the first place, entered a broad-covered quarter porch, where a swarthy tawny attendant, dressed in blue, with white turban, keeps a perpetual watch. Servants in the East lie about all the doors, it appears, and you clap your hands, as they do in the dear old Arabian Nights, to summon them. This servant disappeared through a narrow wicket, which he closed after him, and went into the inner chambers, to ask if his lord would receive us. He came back presently, and rising up from my donkey, I confided him to his attendant lads more sharp, arch, and wicked than these donkey boys don't walk the pave of Paris or London, and past the mysterious outer door. First we came into a broad open court, with a covered gallery running along one side of it. A camel was reclining on the grass there. Near him was a gazelle, two glad jay with his dark blue eye, and a numerous brood of hens and chickens, who furnish his liberal table. On the opposite side of the covered gallery rose up the walls of his long, queer, many-windowed, many-galleried house. There were wooden lattices to those arched windows, through the diamonds of one of which I saw two of the most beautiful, enormous, ogling black eyes in the world, looking down upon the interesting stranger. Pigeons were flapping, and hopping, and fluttering, and cooing about. Happy pigeons, you are, no doubt, fed with crumbs from the hen-tipped fingers of Zuleika. All this court, cheerful in the sunshine, cheerful with the astonishing brilliance eye of the eyes peering out from the lattice bars, was as moldy, ancient, and ruinous as any gentleman's house in Ireland, let us say. The paint was peeling off the rickety old carved galleries. The arabesques over the windows were chipped and worn. The ancientness of the place rendered it doubly picturesque. I have detained you a long time in the outer court. Why the deuce was Zuleika there, with the beautiful black eyes? Hence we passed into a large apartment, where there was a fountain, and another domestic made his appearance, taking me in charge, and relieving the tawny porter of the gate. This fellow was clad in blue too, with a red sash and a gray beard. He conducted me into a great hall, where there was a great large Saracenic oriel window. He seated me on a divan, and stalking off, for a moment, returned with a long pipe and a brass chafing dish. He blew the coal for the pipe, which he motioned me to smoke, and left me there with a respectful bow. This delay, this mystery of servants, that outer court with the camels, gazelles, and other beautiful light things, affected me prodigiously all the time he was staying away, and while I was examining the strange apartment and its contents, my respect and awe for the owner increased vastly. As you will be glad to know how an Oriental nobleman, such as Jay undoubtedly is lodged and garnished, let me describe the contents of this hall of audience. It is about 40 feet long, and 18 or 20 high. All the ceiling is carved, gilt, painted and embroidered with arabesques, and choice sentences of Eastern writing. Some Mameluke Aga, or Bey, whom Mehemet Ali invited to breakfast and massacred, was the proprietor of this mansion once. It has grown dingier, but, perhaps, handsomer, since his time. Opposite the divan is a great bay window, with a divan likewise round the niche. It looks out upon a garden about the size of Fountain Court, Temple, surrounded by the tall houses of the quarter. The garden is full of green. A great palm tree springs up in the midst, with plentiful shrubberies, and a talking fountain. The room beside the divan is furnished with one deal table, value 5 shillings, 4 wooden chairs, value 6 shillings, and a couple of mats and carpets. The table and chairs are luxuries imported from Europe. The regular Oriental dinner is put upon copper trays, which are laid upon low stools. Hence J. Effendi's house may be said to be much more sumptuously furnished than those of the Beys and Agas, his neighbors. When these things had been examined at leisure, Jay appeared. Could it be the exquisite of the Europa and the Roystriers? A man in a long yellow gown, with a long beard somewhat tinged with gray, with his head shaved, and wearing on it, first, a white wadded cotton nightcap. Second, a red tarbouche made his appearance, and welcomed me cordially. It was some time, as the Americans say, before I could realize the semblance Jay of old times. He shuffled off his outer slippers, before he curled upon the divan beside me. He clapped his hands, and languidly called Mustafa. Mustafa came with more lights, pipes, and coffee, and then we fell to talking about London, and I gave him the last news of the comrades in that dear city. As we talked, his oriental coolness and languor gave way to British cordiality. He was the most amusing companion of the club once more. He has adapted himself outwardly, however, to the oriental life. When he goes abroad, he rides a grey horse with red housings, and has two servants to walk beside him. He wears a very handsome grave costume of dark blue, consisting of an embroidered jacket and gaiters, and a pair of trousers, which would make a set of dresses for an English family. His beard curls nobly over his chest, his Damascus scimitar on his thigh. His red cap gives him a venerable, and bay-like appearance. There is no gewgaw parade about him, as in some of your dandified young agas. I should say that he is a major general of engineers, or a grave officer of state. We and the Turkified European, who found us at dinner, sat smoking in solemn divan. His dinners were excellent. They were cooked by a regular Egyptian female cook. We had delicate cucumbers stuffed with forced meats, yellow smoking pilafs, the pride of the Oriental cuisine, kid and fowls, a labouker and a lapyramide. A number of little savory plates of legumes of the vegetable marrow sort. Kebabs with an excellent sauce of plums and piquant herbs. We ended the repast with ruby pomegranates, pulled to pieces, deliciously cool and pleasant. For the meats, we certainly ate them with the infidel knife and fork, but for the fruit, we put our hands into the dish, and flicked them into our mouths in what cannot but be the true Oriental manner. I asked for lamb and pistachio nuts, and cream tarts au poivre, but J.S. Cook did not furnish us with either of those historic dishes. And for drink, we had water freshened in the porous little pots of gray clay, at whose spout every traveler in the East has sucked delighted. Also, it must be confessed, we drank certain sherbets, prepared by the two great rivals, Haji Hodson and Base Bay, the bitterest and most delicious of draughts. O divine Hodson! A camel's load of thy beer came from Beirut to Jerusalem while we were there. How shall I ever forget the joy inspired by one of those foaming cool flasks? We don't know the luxury of thirst in English climes. Sedentary men in cities, at least, have seldom ascertained it. But when they travel, our countrymen guard against it well. The road between Cairo and Suez is jaunty with soda water corks. Tom Thumb and his brothers might track their way across the desert by those landmarks. Cairo is magnificently picturesque. It is fine to have palm trees in your gardens, and ride about on a camel, but, after all, I was anxious to know what were the particular excitements of Eastern life, which detained Jay, who is a town-bred man, from his natural pleasures and occupations in London, where his family don't hear from him, where his room is still kept ready at home, and his name is on the list of his club, and where his neglected sisters tremble to think that their Frederick is going about with a great beard and a crooked sword, dressed up like an odious Turk. In a ark such a costume may be very well, but home, London, a razor, your sister to make tea, a pair of moderate Christian breeches in lieu of those enormous Turkish shulwars, are vastly more convenient in the long run. What was it that kept him away from these decent and accustomed delights? It couldn't be the black eyes in the balcony upon his honor. She was only the black cook, who has done the pilaf, and stuffed the cucumbers. No, it was an indulgence of laziness such as Europeans, Englishmen, at least, don't know how to enjoy. Here he lives like a languid lotus eater, a dreamy, hazy, lazy, tobacco-feed life. He was away from evening parties, he said. He needn't wear white kid gloves, or starched neckcloths, or read a newspaper. And even this life at Cairo was too civilized for him. Englishmen passed through. Old acquaintances would call. The great pleasure of pleasures was life in the desert, under the tents, with still more nothing to do than in Cairo, now smoking, now cantering on Arabs, and no crowd to jostle you, solemn contemplations of the stars at night, as the camels were picketed, and the fires and the pipes were lighted. The night scene in the city is very striking for its vastness and loneliness. Everybody has gone to rest long before 10 o'clock. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.